And we are back, Bostopian News with Evan George, and I'm very happy to be joined by Susan Zollkind, author of The Waltham Murders, One Woman's Pursuit to Expose the Truth Behind a Murder and a National Tragedy. Susan, so happy to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I saw the announcement for your book. I was really anticipating it. I also enjoyed the Hulu documentary that this is almost just a much more fleshed out version of. So for people who have not yet read your book, and I'll probably say that multiple times, definitely go buy the book. It's great. I read it cover to cover very quickly. You're a talented writer, so congratulations on that end. And then I would also recommend checking out the Hulu documentary just to add some visuals to some of the characters that we'll be discussing. And the first thing that I wanted to ask you is, while I was reading your book on two different occasions, people in public saw me reading it, glanced at the cover, and then asked me about it because just the name, the Waltham Murders, jogged something in their memory. And for both these individuals, they knew it had to do with a gruesome murder. It had to do with drugs and has a vague connection to the Boston Marathon bombing. But leaving that last part to the side, can you just describe the scene on September 11th, 2011? How was it reported by both the police and the media around that time period?
That's such an interesting anecdote that you have there. This was a horrific murder. It's on a dead-end street in Waltham, Massachusetts, a leafy neighborhood. There were three men in the apartment with their throats slit. Now just think about the physicality necessary to slit three individuals' throats. There was marijuana dumped on two of the bodies and $5,000 cash left at the scene of the crime. No forced entry. This was an unusual, gruesome homicide.
And really, just to highlight that, the use of a knife, it's something that's in Hollywood quite a bit, but it is very, very unusual to have that type of a scene, especially when, and it sounds like it was first described as this was just like a deal gone bad. This was just like a drug exchange. That seems to be what the first narrative was. But to your point, just the scene itself was highly unusual to fit that narrative.
Stabbings are intimate. You know, with a gun, you can just pull a trigger. Stabbings, you have to get close to the individual. It again, it involves physicality, and it's horrific. You don't typically see drug murders involving stabbings around this part of the world. It does happen. But usually with a murder like that, somebody is trying to send a message, and the message is usually loud and clear. And that wasn't the case here. You know, it wasn't clear what the motivation could be to leave cash on the bodies. You know, the killings took place on 9/11/11. Why was there marijuana dumped on the bodies? It was an unusual crime.
And something that made it a little bit more unusual seems to be the media's coverage of it, because there have certainly been less gruesome, less spectacular scenes that seems to have captured news cycles for weeks, if not months. But this seemed to have dropped off relatively quickly, again, especially when considering the nature of the event. In your investigation, why do you think that was the case, or am I mischaracterizing how the media covered this?
Oh, I think you're exactly right. And remember, I was actually working at NECN I was just out of college. I was a freelance overnight production assistant. And I started looking into this case. I was an aspiring crime reporter, and then one of the victims was my friend, right? And from the get-go, I thought the media's reaction was understated. But then again, I was also contending with my own grief at that point. But I would say that usually in the early stages of a homicide, the media and law enforcement are aligned with their sense of urgency. You know, murders, these are perfect stories for local news channels to cover, right? There's a murder, they're there, they take footage outside, and they listen to law enforcement to set the tone. The tone from law enforcement was, there's nothing to see here. This is a drug killing. Now, all three victims were marijuana dealers back when that was illegal and not a major stream of tax revenue like it is today. And so there being drugs on the bodies immediately made it a drug murder in some ways, which was unusual and concerning because why would somebody put drugs on the victims' bodies unless they wanted investigators to connect the killing to drugs in some ways? Now, I thought that was obvious and that law enforcement would pick up on the clues as well.
And now we somewhat would begin to enter like speculation in terms of, well, why do we think the police may have been characterizing like that? Why does it seem like they missed or the actual like circumstances of the event just seemed to conflict what was the accepted narrative? But moving aside that speculation for now, I did want to get your larger thoughts on the concepts, both of conspiracy theories and how that maybe influenced or impacted you in these 10 years. Because I think, this part of this book is a memoir and what it's like to actually cover a case like this. But again, waiting a little bit later for that, I read the media's reaction to this is because, as you said, that these were drug dealers. And for
Certainly.
and
I'll
for
just
the,
stop you
I don't know,
right
please,
before
please.
we go to your initial point. We can't do anything but speculate as to why law enforcement didn't vigorously pursue this crime because law enforcement has not put forth any information. There's been no form of oversight whatsoever. So there, you can have all sorts of theories. Perhaps they were just disinterested in pursuing a drug crime. That's not safe. And I talked to other members of law enforcement here as well. Police or law enforcement usually vigorously pursue murders that happen within the criminal world because those are the instances when where there's more likely to be retribution, right? Like that's how we stop gang fights. It breaks down into tribalism. But I mean, there could be all sorts of different reasons as to why this case wasn't vigorously pursued. In the book, I established that there was an overlap between the criminal milieu of the victims and members of law enforcement, which could be one reason why this case was not vigorously pursued, for fear, that investigators may not have wanted to look too deep into this for fear of what it might reveal about their own wrongdoing. But yeah, let's talk about conspiracy theories at large.
And I'm going to save that for the end. I want people to have their vegetables and to learn more about what went down before we get to some of those larger things. But for me, when I was both through your book and then also looking at some media clips from around that time, just to put myself in the mindset of what the journalists were covering and the media was portraying, was because the victims were not viewed as sympathetic, that it didn't really become much of a story. Because it is much easier to get people to get interest in a murder case if they can see themselves in the victims. And I think that's part of the reason why, for example, another documentary that came out relatively recently around like the Charles Stewart murder, while at the time that became a national sensation, because the audience who consumes news can view themselves as, oh my God, we drive into the inner city sometimes. We go to this hospital sometimes. This could happen to us, where in this circumstance, the media was very quick to say, well, these are drug dealers. They got in some way what was coming. And so you don't need to worry about it. And it's not much of a story. As somebody who's worked in the media, in journalism in that way, do you think that that is maybe one plausible theory besides, getting into a little bit deeper of this was a cover up, they were told not to report on it? Because I think
Oh,
that.
that's certainly a factor. I mean, and that's certainly a factor. Law enforcement is not supposed to follow the media's cues on that, though, right? I think, this was it was a crime to sell marijuana at the time, and I think people understandably think, okay, these men were criminals, and it's safer to follow the theory initially put forth by law enforcement that this was a targeted crime. It's less scary. So that's certainly a factor. There could be a variety of factors as to why this case wasn't vigorously pursued and why it's slipped through the cracks despite being crucial, like definitively linked to the Boston Marathon bombing, a horrific terrorism attack that I think people in Boston and in greater Boston and the nation can agree is pretty important.
No, absolutely. And we're, slowly coming up on, I believe it will be the 11th anniversary of that event next week. And right before we get to that April 15th, 2013, in the time period between when you first became aware of this murder, and as you said, you were a friend of one of the victims, Eric, how much did you stay with the case from that time period of, we'll say, fall 2011 until April 2013, when some of the names that you were running into became worldwide known, recognized names?
I mean, it was on and off. I was grieving the loss of my friend in many ways. I tried to stop thinking about it. And at the time, I was able to do that because I assumed that despite the kind of know-nothing messaging from law enforcement, that they were doing everything that they could to get to the bottom of this murder. Why wouldn't they, right? And I had previously worked at a local TV station. I was used to getting tips from law enforcement to ask for the public's help, for example, right? And I was curious as to why that didn't happen. But to tell you the truth, it's one of the biggest regrets of my life that I wasn't more vocal, and didn't pursue that instinct of mine that something was wrong. But I was trying to cope. This case intersected with my life. Eric was a friend of mine, but he was a very close friend with my childhood friends. Guys I've known since I was 3 years old, some of them. And so I would, hear things here and there. I went to his funeral, his 1 year memorial service, and I was following the case and looking at other crimes in the area. At the same time, I was trying to detach myself from all things criminal at that point in my life. But you try to get it out of the game, and the game keeps calling you back. So it didn't last for too long. So I was taking notes, but not in the way that I have been pursuing it after the bombing and after Ibrahim Tadashev was killed.
And that follows very nicely right to my next question, though, just to comment on what you just said. Certainly the onus is not on you to remind the police to do what is almost standard operating procedure, which is if a murder occurs in the and the perpetrator isn't immediately apprehended, they ask the public for information. I think you can look at almost any murder that happens in Boston, or just really any physical assault, where if the perpetrator is not immediately apprehended, it is said in the press conference and then repeated both in like the Globe and the Herald. The police are looking at assistance or looking for help from the public. Should do you have any information, call here, contact here. Them not doing that, and there's a few other bizarre things in terms of how they handle this investigation that hopefully we get to. But yeah, that was very, very strange. So again, that
To
onus is
this
not on you.
day, the Middlesex DA and the city of Waltham has yet to make any public call for information in this case. It is officially open and unsolved. They have made no definitive statement about the connection between this case, Tamerlan Tsarnaev's involvement, and Ibrahim Tadashev, despite the overwhelming evidence. And they claim they're still pursuing other additional suspects that could be involved. Yet they have made no public call for help.
Again, one of many just very bizarre, and that is to give them almost the benefit of the doubt, th things in terms of their investigation. But I think, now we have the Marathon bombings, April 15th, 2013. I know a lot of people are very well versed in that in terms of the timeline of the events of that day. And what I want to
Horrific, truly horrific. That it was unfathomably gruesome. And it was not just the victims that were impacted, but the Tsarnaevs set off those bombs while the cameras were already rolling. This was an intelligent terrorist attack in many ways. It really captured the public's imagination. It was unusually violent, again, with the explosives and the means. And it was also right before the new waves of ISIS attacks, a kind of domestic terrorism we haven't seen before. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's a people, I'm sure your audience is well versed in it. It's a horrific, violent tragedy, and the Tsarnaevs ended up influencing many other terrorism attacks down the line, the Orlando Pulse shooting, for example. This was a serious tragedy.
Yeah, and I think up until post since we've had some more, but since 9/11 on 2001, this was the largest terrorist attack on domestic U.S. soil, being April 15th. Do I have that correct?
Exactly. I mean, this was a historic attack. It was a turning point, and it was, I think it impacted all of us because it was the marathon and the images that came out of that attack. And also the fact that, again, in the bombing, the message wasn't immediately clear. Usually terrorist organizations take ownership immediately. So not only did we have this horrific bombing attack, we had that lag time where the city, the whole region was just waiting in fear. We didn't know who did it, and we didn't know why.
And I've been reflecting back on that day in that instance, and I attributed, because I think that's a great point, that it was very bizarre that when we look at it now, that there was not a clear reason. And if you look at really any terrorist attack, almost since, you will see somebody posted a manifesto an hour before, or the live stream during the event and was expressing it. And part of me was thinking that maybe this was the reason for that was 2013, social media, while around, is still not really hitting its stride in the way that it does 2014, 2015, 2016. And I think maybe that was like a lesson learned by terrorists or people who commit acts of violence later of like, how do you do this? And just for me, as somebody who just thinks about how one thing inspires the other, I went back to, well, maybe in 2013 they didn't think of, posting on Twitter a rationale and connecting it, and just like what is just viewed as messaging and terrorist attacks. This is just a wild speculation, different from
Well, I
all
think you make a
discussion,
great
but.
point regarding historically the widespread use of social media, but you also have to think about Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his MO. Again, the 9/11/11 murders in Waltham, in which two men who were Israeli Jews with an Israeli background and Brendan Mess were killed. That message wasn't clear at the time later. This is Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who was radicalized to a large degree by Alex Jones. He was also a reader of Sherlock Holmes. Now, I think he liked drama. He liked a good plot twist, and I think he also liked feeling like he was smarter than other people, like he was getting one over on them. And I also think he thought he could get away with it.
And immediately following this next question, we're going to start getting into his headspace more. But th there's another person, and this, when you discussed it in your book, the we'll call it the interview and then death on May 23rd, 2013. Even me, while I was reading it, as somebody who tries to keep up on the news, had this thought of like, oh yeah, like I remember that there was Massachusetts State Police were down in Florida talking to someone. Someone died. So. Again, April 15th, 2013, the Boston Marathon bombing. About a month and a half later, there was this shooting down in Florida. And if I mispronounce, please correct it. Ibrahim, is it Todashev or
Tadashev.
Tadashev? Can you explain who he was and what happened on that May 23rd, 2013?
Sure. Okay. So you have the three Waltham murder victims. Brendan Mess rented the apartment with a woman who was his girlfriend, Hiba. Brendan was the youngest of the three friends, and he was kind of alpha. He was sort of a legend, and even in his life, he was a fighter. He had a purple belt in jiu-jitsu. And antics about him. He was smart and really loved by his friends. But antics about him usually accompanied his high threshold for pain, for example. So Tamerlan Tsarnaev, before he was a terrorist, and this is an important part of his trajectory, was a boxer. He had this huge ego of he wanted to be an Ivy League professor, an engineer, and then an Olympic boxer. And he was a good boxer, but he got barred from the competition because of his citizenship. Anyway, you have Tamerlan, who's from Dagestan, Chechnya, or Central Asia, but is really a Cambridge kid. He's lived in Cambridge for a decade. and Brendan Mass, who go to the local gym, who I crew, and are really close friends. They spar. And then there's another individual who also works out at the gym, who Tamlin knows from his group of Chechen friends, Ibrahim Tadashev, in a smaller weight class, mushroom cut hair, cauliflower ears, because he's a determined fighter. And that happens when people don't wait for their ears to heal after a beating and a nice broken nose. So all three of them worked out at this Y Crew gym. And at some point, and this becomes a focal point of my investigation, Ibrahim leaves town and goes to Florida. He has a white Mercedes car and a small nondescript condo right outside of Universal Studios. He's there with his white Mercedes. He has a wife who his mother knows about, and a mother does not know about his girlfriend. His father knows about the girlfriend. And so he's living there with his girlfriend. And then after the bombing, he is apprehended almost immediately after Tamerlan is identified in Florida, and the questioning begins.
And it seems like they interviewed him again during this questioning for quite a while. It wasn't a quick 2 minutes and then something went wrong. It seemed to have lasted maybe a few hours. You can correct me if I have that.
Yes, so he was being questioned for a month in the lead up to this fatal interview, right? And he's being followed by FBI agents everywhere with tinted windows. He's going to the police station all the time. His other friends are getting nervous. They're being questioned. And then at a certain point, well, initially, the focus of that questioning was all about his relationship to Tamerlan Tsarnaev and the Boston Marathon bombing. It doesn't seem like they were interested in his connection to the Waltham murders at first. Again, they're approaching the homicide as an afterthought rather than the inciting event in some ways. So he go then in the middle of, I guess, early May, the Massachusetts investigators get involved. They fly down to Florida. Ibrahim goes back to an Orlando police station. He talks to the same Florida agents, but the Massachusetts guys are watching the interview from another room. And apparently he's cagey about when exactly it was that he left Boston. He says he left Boston well before the murders, but they don't ask him about the murders directly. They do ask his girlfriend about the murders directly. She's waiting outside. She gets pulled into another room. Investigators say, you know, we think he did something before with a knife. She says, no, it's not true. He's my boyfriend. I've known him for 6 months and we have a cat. Like, it could never be. And they say, yes, we think it's true. And they wanted her to inform, according to her account. And she said, no. And her immigration papers were expired and they take her away. So Ibrahim comes out of this interview and his girlfriend is gone. Okay. So fast forward 10 days or so later, the Massachusetts investigators come back to Florida. Now, this is a Massachusetts state trooper who's assigned to the Middlesex County District Attorney's Office. He's actually the guy in charge. The person who they're ultimately taking orders from is the Middlesex County District Attorney. There's also an FBI agent there and another Massachusetts state trooper. Now, the focus has been on the FBI before, so that's why I emphasize this. They get back into town. They contact a Florida Joint Terrorism Task Force officer who is essentially Ibrahim's handler, and he says, you know, there's investigators from Massachusetts. They want to talk, just like one last interview. And Ibrahim's pissed. He's like, you stole my girlfriend. I'm not going to go to the police station and talk to you. And you know, the reports say, well, eventually we convinced Ibrahim to meet. They were also circling him and his friends in, again, these unmarked vehicles with tinted windows. And so Ibrahim says, okay, like, I'll talk. Let's go to the hookah lounge. There's a hookah bar where he used to hang out. And the task force officer says, "How about someplace more private?" And he suggests his home. And so they all go gung ho to interview Ibrahim Tadashev, a trained fighter with a hair trigger temper, in his Orlando home, where there's a sword hanging on the wall. No. And he, Ibrahim, had recently beat a man bloody over a parking space, sent him to the hospital in a road rage incident just a couple of weeks before. So he thought that's what they wanted to ask him about. The investigators were fully aware that he did this. And he asked them to take off their shoes, and they step inside. And that begins the 3.5 hour interview, which ends moments after midnight, when Ibrahim Tadashev is shot 7 times, including once in the top of his head.
And I just wanted to point out one thing in case it was confusing for the audience in terms of like the FBI surveillance around him, because there are really you can categorize surveillance in two different camps. One is when they don't want you to know that you're being watched, and the other is when they really want you to know you're being watched. And it seems like in this case, it was the latter, where their tailing and their surveillance of him was so obvious that it was meant to be almost a nuisance. And I think sometimes that's used as a strategy to get people to work with you because it's essentially saying, we will not stop harassing you. And if you want us to go away, you need to meet with us and have this conversation. I generally view it as a very smart tactic that they use to increase pressure to get people to have these sort of talks where you're not really legally required to, because it's not a warrant out for your arrest.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look at another one of the Tsarnaev's associates, Kirilazon Matnov, he was being openly surveilled for a year, and there was no arrest. But on when an FBI agent testified, he said, "Yeah, that was our technique. We wanted to make sure that he knew." They didn't say, I don't recall his explanation of why they would want the individual to know. But one of Ibrahim's attorneys, at least an attorney for his family, suggested that they wanted to make him scared. I'm sure that's how he felt, that there's no way out. So you're putting a cage fighter into a small condo where he already feels that there's no escape. And to question him about a horrific homicide linked to the largest terrorism attack in the United States since 9/11.
And it seems like, at the end of that 3-hour interview, which I believe you discuss this in your book, it was being recorded, but then all of a sudden the recording stopped, battery ran out, maybe, or the camera malfunctioned, and something occurs, and there's now 7 bullet wounds, and he's found dead. It seems like there's some back and forth with the autopsy. Was he shot in the back initially? Was he shot in the front, and it was more of like a diving motion.
So let
And
me just start with the audio and then I can get into the bullets. There's a lot of talk in the reports about, the camera not being, he wasn't consistently filmed. There was an agent who just pulled out, or I think it was a trooper who just pulled out his like family camcorder, and then he was deleting from or using his phone and deleting space, which again, why are you deleting your initial interview? But what I think is more concerning is that the other state trooper, Gagné, the one assigned to the Middlesex DA, has an audio recorder in his pocket. And there's no reason for him to need to turn that audio recorder on and off. And yet it does not capture the entire interview. Of course, those interviews in their complete form, the video and the audio, and the transcripts, the full transcripts, are locked under seal. I've never been able to access them in whole, in their entirety.
And the rationale for that is because it's still an ongoing investigation.
Yes, and then there's links to the Tsarnaev case, and yeah, it's an open and active investigation. They say that, it could interfere with, an arrest down the line.
And If you had a, I was going to transition to Tamlin, but if you had any
Oh,
last.
if you want to talk about the bullets, I would say, and then there was much ado made about how, Ibrahim was a trained fighter. He was trained to go for the legs. And that's why the bullets in the back were kind of shot in a download, a downward motion. That does track, I would say, especially when the how the bullet was shot in his head. There's certainly questions, but it does track. Was it necessary on a number of different levels? I'm not sure.
And as you said, with the police being so like not forthcoming or not open about what happens, when people are deleting video clips, when they're turning off audio clips, when they're not making those things available, there's some you could have one theory that says, oh, because they're about to talk about things that they don't want out in the public. Or maybe they're going to say something to him that they don't want the members of the general public to be aware that like this is how it really works with law enforcement and dangerous individuals. There can be another though train of thought of saying maybe during the interview they riled them up and this could have been prevented if they didn't use some certain like interview tactic and they feel like, oh, we can kind of get in trouble. We didn't really handle this interview well. Let's cover ourselves. And again, it just opened up the speculation.
Here's what we know, though. They're hiding something.
Yes.
I think it's a mistake to assume you know what. And I think it's a mistake if you're trying to get answers from authorities to confront them with a theory rather than a fact, then it's clear they're hiding something. What and why? What are the reasons for hiding it? What it is that they're hiding? And those are separate questions.
We're now on to probably what a lot of people will be looking through your book to find is the history and the connections with Tamerlan Tsarnaev and the events of September 11th, 2011, in Waltham. And you went into it a little bit about who Tamerlan was, particularly about the role that boxing played in his life and his dreams and ambitions within boxing. Could you go into detail a little bit more about both, who he was, what were his dreams as what I'm going to assume to be, he was probably maybe in his mid to late teens at that point, and why those dreams did not come true?
He was in his 20s, and we can also just go into like the evidence too later if that's something you want to do. Tamerlan Tsarnaev, I mean, he is regrettably an interesting character, and I know he would love everybody to think that. But he had his family is Chechen ethnically. His father, his mother, was from Dagestan, the ethnic group called the Avars. It's this fascinating part of the world, the North Caucasus, very mountainous, and has had decades, I guess more than a century, of clashes with the Russian Empire, in which the rebellious Chechen mountain people fought back, and that's kind of the mythos of the people. And there's been series of horrific wars. First Chechen War, where the family, lived this ping pong existence because the Chechens were forced out of Chechnya after World War II for no legitimate reason anyway, but they were all sh shipped off in trains where too packed for anybody to sit down, and dumped in Central Asia. And the Tsarnaev marriage with his father and his mother was a bit of a scandal, because they are not the same ethnic, they didn't have the same ethnic background. I think Zubaydah's family, accepted Anzor, but Anzor's family never accepted Zubaydah. Later, they would call her a witch, that Anzor was her zombie. And the Tsarnaevs moved constantly. They never stayed in one place. Zubaydah also had a lofty ambitions. She was the youngest daughter of a shepherd. Her mother died when she was young, and she had been passed around between her older brothers' families. And then she met Anzor. She wore, flashy outfits. She was fashionable, and appears she's smart. It was quick to learn Chechen and then quick to learn English when eventually they did come to America, first with only their youngest son, Jahar. There's two sisters, and then Tamerlan. And then Tamerlan came to America when he was 16, and he went to high school with some of my friends. We're about the same age, didn't live too far away. And, in high school, he was this like dorky kid with a unibrow, right? He asked one friend of mine to prom. She said no. He showed up alone. He played soccer outside, and he, again, considered himself to be an intellectual and tried to teach himself English, reading Sherlock Holmes books, the English and Russian translations side by side. And not really an effective way to learn English, is it?
No, I can't remember.
He considered himself a pianist, a musician, but was booted out of jazz class. He had these great ambitions, but didn't really have an understanding or a willingness to, take the steps needed to reach an obtainable goal, right?
But it sounds like he found that in boxing.
Yeah, and there's also this complicated history, if you go into the Chechen wars and Chechen identity of who is he really? Even with his Chechen friends, there's a tight-knit group of Chechen friends, and Ibrahim was Chechen, not Chechen, Dagestani. And they would say that, Tamerlan wasn't really one of us because he spoke with a Dagestani accent. No, it is one of those cases where somebody just can never feels like they fit in or has an understanding of who they are, because again, the Chechen identity is really appears to be, a mythos, like most identities are, right? And you can see it appears like Tamerlan was aspiring to, be a legend. Hercules, as his mother called him. And again, if MMA is really big in Chechnya and Dagestan. His father was a boxer. And so one of the places that he did fit in, it was the boxing ring. He started in the Somerville boxing ring. He didn't take to instruction very well. Now, he boxed in the European style. That meant he kept his resting hand low, right? So he could have more force with his jab, but it meant he couldn't protect his face. Most of the time that worked out for him, but when it didn't, he gets a shot right into his face. And his coaches would, try to teach him, and Anzor would interject. He was always going to do it his own way. He knew better. He does very well as an amateur. And then he becomes a bit of a drunk. He goes to Bunker Hill Community College. He's again hanging out with these other Chechen guys who were going to the same like clubs that I was in Cambridge, not too far. Just
Ever attend the Middle East?
oh yeah. Oh yeah. Did you, sir, are you?
Yes, I'm just thinking of, what are some clubs that I
Oh yeah.
went to someone recently in Cambridge and
I write about in the book, like the living in the home for lost DJs for several years. So my roommates used to DJ there, and it used to be a fun scene. And we, I obviously like overlapped in more ways than one, right? It was right before the rent in Cambridge started to really spike, and there was a different, feeling. Cambridge is really, it's known as an academic city. But the Cambridge that I loved, it's a city of immigrants, right? It's a city that really celebrates diversity and has a different relationship to that than Boston. in some ways. And so even though Tamerlan was a he's known as from Dagestan or Chechnya, he was very much like part of what Cambridge was all about. And so were his friends. I mean, it was a small Chechen community, but that culture at large. He's talking to this, he gets hooked on conspiracy theories really first, right?
And actually, right before we talk about him getting hooked on conspiracy theories, one thing in terms of his timeline that I was curious about, because as you said, he was a talented boxer. He had an unorthodox style. He was able to go to the Golden Gloves, which is this big competition that's every year here in Massachusetts. And it sounds like he does very well there. Did he win the Golden Gloves?
Yeah, so he has a period where he's a bit of a drunk, and then he gets back into boxing, right? And he's determined, and he wins when the first nationals he or in a previous nationals he wins regionals, and at the Golden Gloves boxing competition, he wins regionals, but at nationals he has the flu. Now the rules at the time weren't clear. They were clarified at a notable point, as I will describe. So Tamlin somehow got it into his head that if he, won nationals, then he could go to the Olympics, and like citizenship wouldn't be an issue either. That Tamlin would be so great at boxing that they'd make an excuse.
Which in truth
And there.
isn't that far-fetched. There are many cases where we give citizenship to athletes simply so they can compete for our Olympics. Just
Okay, but that's a lofty goal,
yes.
and also it didn't work out for him. And that it's sort of that's interesting to note because at the time, Golden Gloves, New England, had a rule where American citizens could compete in nationals when it wasn't an Olympic year, because nationals was a stream for the Olympic team, right? And then Tamerlan, coincidence or not, was berated not only an opponent in a boxing match, and Tamerlan was like flashy. He would wear like alligator shoes, like big scarves, and would do kind of the you're going down in the gym before the match. And he made a mistake, perhaps, of berating not just his opponent, but his opponent's coach. And shortly thereafter, the rules were changed. And now only American citizens would have the opportunity to fight in nationals. So the following year, Tamerlan won regionals, but he was an American. And so a man he beat squarely took his place and went to nationals instead. And that's when he seems to really fall apart. Rather than aspiring to this, I don't know, almost European playboy aesthetic, he's got the aviators, he's got pointed shoes, he says he dresses in European style, he's flashy. His aesthetic changes to focus more on his identity as a Muslim. He's makes a show of praying in the gym, where Ibrahim always did. Now Tamerlan does. And remember, Tamerlan is a peacock, so it's everything he does is about show for him. And so that becomes at least his more outwardly identity. And he also starts engaging in conspiratorial talk about Jewish people with Jewish people at every opportunity, right? And we'd seen he essentially blames the Jews for not being able to go to nationals, right? And there has been, this wasn't his turn to conspiracy theories began previously to this, when he's lost earlier, he's picking up Alex Jones. He's talking to this somewhat mysterious man named Misha, and a convert to Islam. And according to his brother-in-law, Tamerlan would mostly talk about demons, and politics and conspiracies along with religion. And Tamlin's family would later say that Tamlin wasn't educated in his own faith to the extent to have a real discussion. So he creates this somewhat warped identity that is ideologically based, but I would just distance it from, the faith itself is what most people would practice. And he's also picking up propaganda from, national groups that have been were hijacked by Wahhabi extremists. And he's trying to figure out who he is, I guess, without his last dream, which was to be a boxer and to be a star, like his mother always told him he was.
And it sounds like, at this time in the in his life, before the Waltham murders, he goes on a trip to Dagestan. And it seems like even before that trip, do I have that correct, the timeline?
It's after the Waltham murders. You know,
So
all of a
after the
sudden he has money to go on a trip to
yes,
Dagestan
thank you.
after the Waltham murders.
And it seems like before the murders themselves, though, the FBI ha already had contact with him.
Yes.
And so can you, because much has been made about the connection between the FBI and Tamerlan and his brother in the lead up to the Boston Marathon bombing, but it sounds like their relationship, and by that I just mean the FBI's involvement in Tamerlan's life, predates the Waltham murders as well. When did that relationship start? And then it does seem like it's a little bit of a separate question. Can you just describe this trip that he goes to Dagestan?
Well, in regards to the FBI's interactions with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, in regards to the FBI's interaction with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, there are a lot of questions, but something clearly went wrong, right? This did not end well. It's interesting, right? Because the initial tip to look into Tamerlan comes from Russian intelligence. Now, Russia has a heated, historied relationship to Chechnya, right? Chechens are seen as criminals, extremists. It kind of it coincides, actually, with America's seizure of native people's land here. Russia's history with Chechen kind of it begins at the same time. And there are conspiracy theories, in Russia in which Chechens may well have been framed for an apartment bombing, actually, in Russia, which was how Putin then, seized power. He blamed an attack on the Chechens. It's very unclear if that's correct. Actually, there was an arrest later and no Chechens were arrested. He n nonetheless used that as impetus to start a war and become a household name, kind of capitalizing on Russian discrimination and hatred for Chechen people, right? At least that's a narrative that's well accepted in Western media, right? But it kind of gives some context to why somebody with that background would be drawn to conspiracy theories. It's part of his life story, really, is one. And there's a tip that comes from Russian intelligence, tipping the legal attaché, the FBI's legal attaché in Moscow, that Tamerlan and his mother are going getting increasingly radical, and they're considering joining underground bandit groups in Chechnya, and to look into them. At the same time, according to reporting, the Russia was tapping Tamerlan's phone calls with his mother, and they apparently discussed a potential plan for Tamerlan to commit jihad. This is in March 2011, right? I'm pretty sure I can go back and check, but I'm pretty sure March 2011, Russia's already tapping the phones, right? And then there's a tip, and Tamerlan's parents are interviewed first on April 15th. same anniversary close to the bombing. And in the second interview, Tamerlan and his father are questioned. And so we have the unredacted notes of that interview. They're called 302 notes. That's what FBI's note-taking system is. And it's concerning, according to intelligence officials. You know, looking at the notes, it looks like whoever was taking them was taken in by Tamerlan. You know, there's notes like Tamerlan never fights bad, like good people. He always like sticks up for the underdog. And you know, it almost sees Tamerlan likes Spartan culture. It's almost like they're fanboying over Tamerlan. According to the like FBI 302 note, Tamerlan is just like this wrongfully questioned man who always fights with a good guy. But it's also strange because that note also claims that Anzor claims that prior to this FBI interview, that four men came and said that they wanted to talk to Tamerlan. Four men in suits didn't leave their cards. It's hard to be sure how to make sense of it, because we also have Anzor's medical records in which he's like hallucinating lizards and people are calling his name and he's like
He was struck in
paranoid.
the head during what it seems to be a robbery or an assault, correct?
He was, yeah, struck in the head with a pipe outside of a Russian social club, right? And his he may also have had impairments due to his own boxing career. And again, those horrific wars in Chechnya, where according to his doctors, he had been in a filtration camp, which is where Russian officials would just hold Russian men and torture them, sometimes sexually. So that was not only a violent endeavor, but it was also a great source of shame. Zubaydah, you know, the Tsarnaevs have a very loose relationship with the truth. She claims that actually, no, he was never in a filtration camp, that he was a prosecutor and he was tortured by the mob. Then again, he was never a prosecutor. So it's hard to know what to make sense of this, because he's paranoid about the Russians, and then also the Russians are tapping his wife's phone, right? It's unclear, but according to, you know, former FBI agents that I spoke to, American federal agents are not going to approach somebody in a group of four. They are not going to approach somebody and not leave a card if they're trying to be in touch. And remember that prior to this second interview, that, you know, Anzor and Zubaydah had just been questioned. So look, there's a lot of questions, but I think the narrative that best fits the facts is that the FBI was sloppy and they didn't have a grasp on, you know, Russia, you know, Chechen history, what this tip meant, why they should follow it. It really looks like they had one pulled over them. And you could come up with other narratives that may or may not be true, but I think those are the questions, you know, based on the facts, you know, the documents that we have, that I would like people to ask the FBI. You know, the why wasn't this more vigorously pursued? Like, why did the agent take notes as they did? And what was the FBI's, or also the CIA, which was later tipped off, like, what was the intelligence protocol? Like, how educated were you about what was happening in Russia? And again, what you see, you know, after the bombing is Russian interference in the narrative. And that has only become clear years later. And I think it's another concern of mine that we just weren't prepared. You know, our intelligence agencies were not as coordinated or informed as perhaps they needed to be.
And following just that last point, and I do have a comment to something you said earlier, but that the lack of coordination, at least in term or sloppiness by a national security state, the lack of coordination, that framing does work with how Tamerlan is able to both go to Dagestan for 6 months or so and come back while also being on the terrorist watch list or on a watch list and basically flow between the borders unencumbered or, unmolested by our security state. Do I have that correct?
Yes, I mean, of course, there could be other explanations, but I think we make a mistake when we assume that law enforcement is more capable. You know, the narrative that there could be another explanation. It could have been some sort of highly coordinated something or rather. And sure, possibly, but also that was the narrative that Russia put forth and that many others latched on to. Shortly after the bombing, which is another reason perhaps to take pause.
And right before I kind of insert you in this narrative, and we've been dancing around the concept of conspiracy theories for a while, the point that you made earlier, and it jogged something in my mind when I read it in your book, that the FBI would never approach people in groups, just not necessarily coincidentally, but in my own experience, to insert myself, I've had three FBI agents and a member of the Secret Service come to my door in a group, and when I read your comment that that isn't necessarily standard practice, my first thought was, that's been my experience with them. That was just a small little anecdote, though they did leave a card, so perhaps it was a little bit separate.
Wow, well, that is certainly a story for
Certainly,
another day.
absolutely for another day.
Yeah, and then if they are approaching you like that and that isn't supposed to be standard federal procedure, then that raises other questions as well. In any case, it's really hard to say who those four. We can say this is edited because I just had a small coughing fit and I was about to say that. I don't think there's any way to know who those four mysterious men were. But there are blatant reasons to be concerned about how the FBI handled this investigation. And if you look at the Intelligence General's report, which came out a year later, it's very clear that the FBI is hiding something. That's explicit. What are they hiding? I don't know. Could it be matters of national security? Perhaps. Would it be more consistent with the reporting that I found in the story, that they're just trying to cover their own ass? Yeah.
And now getting to it, my general definition of conspiracy theories is an alternative theory, normally around a major historical event, but that's not necessary. But an alternative theory that goes against the institutionally accepted narrative of events from respectable institutions like our political institutions, social institutions like our legacy media. And if you have an alternative theory to that, to me, that means it's a conspiracy theory, and that's not me labeling it as a positive or a negative.
Oh, I would add some so a conspiracy is just a group of people like operating together. Now that's people can be charged criminally for conspiracy. A theory is an idea that may or may not be true, right? So I don't think it's misguided to be curious about conspiracy theories, right? Because people do collude and cover things up or plot and plan, like certainly. The problem is when you get people get really intoxicated by those theories because everything adds up. They begin to tie other errant facts like into the theory, and it makes for a really satisfying narrative, right? I think that was some readers have had frustration with this book because it doesn't work into a conspiratorial narrative. There's no Scooby-Doo ending. It's
And that was really the first part of this, as we're wrapping up, is how difficult was it, or was it difficult for you in the last 10, I think, what are we at now, 13 years since the murders, to simply just not slip into pure, I'll call it conspiracy hysteria, though again, I just want to make sure that my listeners understand that I'm not saying that there aren't elements to this, that there are very strong points that it ties to what
I
can
think it's
generally be described.
very natural to think conspiratorial, but I
And
mean
did you struggle with that?
we should also consider that like Russian propaganda was explicitly putting forth conspiratorial narratives, and you've got to ask why. I think that what's difficult about a conspiracy theory is if you think there's a, like an evil cabal at the strings of everything, you're not going to get engaged with your city councilor, right? You're not going to take action. It gives people a sense of outrage, but also helplessness, right? Rather than if you look at what went wrong step by step, that there's more of a path to get involved. And that's part of the reason why conspiratorial thinking can derail the narratives of well-meaning actors. How did I stay focused? Well, I was thinking about this, and look, I come from a somewhat academic background. I worked in a science lab before that. When I look at my work, I consider not just what I think might be true or my hunches, but when I lay out the evidence, would somebody else come to the same conclusion, right? Based on the facts, like, could my idea that I put forth be replicated, right? That somebody else would read the same information and come to more or less the same conclusion. Because if they can't, and I missed something or I took a wrong leap, that's embarrassing.
And again, over the last 13 years or so, conspiracy thinking, I think since 2015 has, hit a zenith. We had the QAnon movement, but there's also been a lot of documentaries, investigations. It reminds me a little bit of the 1970s when a lot of this information about us as security states started to become public. Just recently this year, there was the Octopus Murders on Netflix. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that documentary. There was a podcast series that I think came out last year called The Alphabet Boys, which went into the role of the FBI in using insiders to infiltrate the George Floyd movements. There was a book called Chaos, which goes and
Conspiracies happen. Conspiracy th happen. I look at the work of Catherine Olmsted. I think she's the historian, and she cites like the pretext for the war in Iraq, for example. They certainly happen. I think the danger is that when people get hooked onto these theories instead of the facts, look, Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan has been in charge of this investigation since the bombing, right? It's been the same office in charge of the Waltham triple homicide from day one. That has never changed. Think about what happened into the after the murders, in the lead up to the bombing, their outstanding lack of curiosity, right? Concerning. It doesn't really matter if nobody liked the Waltham murder victims. I happen to like one of them a lot, and I have respect for the other two. That doesn't matter. You want to live in a society where somebody's in charge of addressing homicides. Like that's a basic public function that's kind of bedrock, if you think about it. Why wasn't this case vigorously pursued? And then you have Ibrahim Tadashev's death. In the aftermath of his murder, the outrage and the concern was all directed to the FBI, because ultimately it was a FBI agent who pulled the trigger. Now, task forces are a theme throughout this book. And what happens again and again is officials involved in those task forces, which were formed to a great extent after 9/11, because coordination is helpful. But officials also seem to be able to use task forces to deflect responsibility. Like, who was even in charge of that interview? It took me FOIA requests and combing through thousands of pages of documents to find out that actually the FBI wasn't calling the shots. Not really. It was Middlesex ADA Stephen Laughlin, who was in communication with the men when they came up with a plan to confront a trained fighter with a hair trigger temper about a gruesome homicide in his own home, and had no plan to arrest him after he confessed. So he's in this room for 2 hours, and finally he snaps and says, "Yeah, I was there. We did it." The DA, the ADA, is texting this man, "Don't arrest him." Now, look, you can criticize the men who are in that apartment, but you have their superior putting them in a dangerous situation. He's not even at his office when this is going on. He's saying, oh, you got a confession. Just, hold him there while I go write up a warrant now. Time passes. They're waiting to hear from the ADA. Finally, one of the men has to step outside and give him a call. All this while, they've been ordered to let Ibrahim Tadashev move freely around the apartment after he's confessed. So talk about, putting this man in a corner. You're chasing him with undercover cars. And there was certainly federal coordination, to be clear. You're confronting him with evidence that says definitively he did it. I'm not sure if that's actually what they knew. They had quite a lot of evidence. But that's the plan, It would be shocking to me, knowing what I know about Ibrahim Tadashev, if he didn't snap, right? But there's been conspiratorial thinking around the events. The Middlesex DA is only just now being questioned about their role in the Waltham murders, right? Because their official line is, oh, it's an open investigation. Maybe the reason why it's open is because you killed one of the men who did it. Like, oh, without any form of accountability. And look, maybe they did their best, but as a citizen of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I'd like to know that an internal review was conducted. At the least, they won't provide an answer. And then you get Martha Coakley, who is a veteran, was a veteran of the Middlesex office, AG Martha Coakley. She doesn't get involved. She could have. She doesn't. And then you have Maura Healey, who again looks the other way. Now, she did this again with the same ADA, Stephen Laughlin, in another case. It's the Somerville detective, Daniel Dante DeFonso. So this detective is texting an informant, and he texts a drug dealing informant the location of another individual who the informant believes robbed him. And the informant then stabs a man. The mayor of Somerville wanted some sort of accountability, right? But ADA Stephen Laughlin writes a letter of recommendation and says, we really need Dante DeFonso on our team. And Maura Healey goes along.
And this, we could certainly talk about this for the 5 hours, especially bringing up some of the names you just dropped. And my last question for you, and you've been very generous with your time, thank you, is it doesn't sound so, but with this book coming out, you've spent the last, dedicatedly on this since 2015. Oh, I'm sorry, 2013, but you were involved in 2011. Do you have a sense of closure that you've taken this as far as you can, and until new information is made available publicly, there's really not much? I guess another way of phrasing it is, while emotionally this will always stay with you, intellectually you'll always stay on top of it. Are you moving on from this case, or are you continuing your investigation to try to uncover more?
The word closure isn't a book jacket. I mean, I was motivated. I have some, I have a complicated relationship with that word, right? My motivation to pursue this story from the very beginning is the same thing that motivates me to do all of my journalistic work, right? I mean, I'm not a perfect person in any means, but I'm motivated, and I take great satisfaction of providing, some sort of public service with my work. And I made a commitment, unlike initially before the bombing, that I would stick with it. And I wanted to provide a record of account where no such record existed, so people can be informed now and also years from now. And I wanted to make sure it was accurate. And yeah, I did that. We can talk more about, finally getting the documents pertaining to the woman who found the bodies and her other
Another
dead
person we didn't
lovers.
have time to discuss, and another reason people really should read your book. Hiba is a fascinating character that I more than anyone else, I had a very difficult time understanding who they were and the truth behind their involvement. But
Certainly, and I think we may have a hard time ever finding that truth because the Middlesex DA has not pursued those questions, right? But insofar as getting that information on the record and also obtaining those documents via FOIA, I came what I did what I came to do. Having the library journal, call this book a definitive resource and a starred review so far as my achieving my primary objective. Absolutely, I did it. I think now, there is the next part of the story, which is how do those in power react now? And I started sort of a quick little like Substack, on the eve of publication because I just wanted to take note on it. I think that's part of the story as well. And I think the next chapter is really like conversations. I've had a very interesting time connecting to people. And it's a lot of information. And so I'm curious of how, of what comes next. But then, yeah, no, at a certain point, which probably, we'll see where this goes, I'm gonna likely report on other topics. But this also, there are a lot of points that someone should follow up on in regards to this story. And I'm tired. I'd like to work on a story that does not have any personal connection to me at all, but it's important. And as a journalist, I don't think I can look my face in the mirror and ignore these issues.
Well, we'll leave it there. And again, read the book, Susan Zollkind, The Waltham Murders, One Woman's Pursuit to Expose the Truth Behind a Murder and a National Tragedy. Ashley, stick around for just 1 second, but thank you again so much for your time. And I hope you also stuck around. I'm still trying to figure out if I like intros or outros or a combination of the two for when I do interviews, but for now, let's see how this works. And I'm sure for some editing notes, you noticed one addition that is rare for me to use during my podcast in general, and that was the little musical interlude. Essentially, about halfway through, Susan and I decided to take a little break. And the only other editing thing that you need to be made aware of is when she referenced that I cut something because she had a coughing fit. And so there's about 6 to 7 seconds that I cut out, which of course is very comical given the topic of our conversation, when she had a little bit of a coughing fit. Now, the music I chose was from a very, very close friend of mine, and the album is Mirror Cult. And that was a portion of Starella as She Is Sung. So if you enjoy guitar instrumentals and you like the little tune and you wished I shut up and just let the music play, you can find Mirror Cult wherever it is you find music, I'll say. And though I know I said it multiple times during the interview, really do go buy the book if this is, an interest of you. True crime, the Boston Marathon bombings, the connections between our national security state and criminal elements or dangerous people, we'll call it. I certainly have a lot of my own theories that I didn't want to interject into the interview, but if you would like to hear them, and if you would like to hear more of Susan, and hopefully we'll have Susan back on the program, well, the best way to do that is to make sure there is still a program. And the best way of doing that is heading on over patreon.com/bostopiannews, where you can become a Patreon member, really as a way of saying thank you to me for the podcast, for the TikTok and Instagram videos, and to encourage me just to keep going for as little as a cup of coffee a month. You can buy me a beer if you're cool. You can buy me one lunch a month if you're loaded. And of course, there's even an upper tier that no one has yet taken advantage of if you truly want to show some love. But if you do not have the means to do so, that's okay. All of my content is free and available to you, and you can still find it neatly categorized again at patreon.com/bostopiannews. And with that, I'll see you all next week. And as always, hope you have a great rest of your day. Goodbye.